right, then. It is 5 p.m. Time for American Hit Radio, the Friday edition. On 90.3 WHPC, WHPC HD in Garden City, New York. I'm Tom Ryan, and of course, my lovely wife and co-host.
I'm running the board.
You hear that voice? That's her. That's Heidi Morales. That's
my levels girl. Were very low.
And of course, on Friday, we call the show How Music Changed, because we try to go deep onto what I have 250 topics that I consider to be representative of some of the most important or influential acts or styles of music or record labels or things like that, that more or less help to complete, to tell a complete story of the history of recorded music, which is absurdly ambitious, but it's fun to try. And it was only about a month ago when we started this series, which is called The History of Pink Floyd, a band that managed to become one of the most important rock and roll bands of the era, and also the fact that they are more or less one of the primary inventors of progressive rock. Although what we have heard up until now, that was not the case, because the first three parts of our series were mostly dedicated to the music of the original songwriter, the most significant songwriter for the band, Syd Barrett. But we ended Syd's reign with last week's show by playing almost everything that I could come up with that Syd had done with the band up until that point in time, and then vanished. So now with part four, seeing as how Pink Floyd lost their primary singer-songwriter, the remainder of the band, which, by the way, now includes David Gilmour as a full-time member, they needed direction. Each of them was capable of writing songs, but their attempts at writing a hit single, proved that really none of them had a knack for commerciality like Syd did. Syd was totally way out there, but his songs were incredibly entertaining. Now, that meant that the band's opportunity to remain pop stars had virtually evaporated. So earlier in their career, the band had been approached to provide music for a film, and we talked about that in part one of our series. So without any real commercial abilities among the players who are left, the idea of maybe being a band that functioned as a source for film music actually became a serious consideration. They began to think, hey, you know, we're not really going to be able to sell much, so maybe if we just made music for film, we could have a career doing that. So this part of the story covers that era when the band found themselves searching for an appropriate direction. Now, their second album was entitled A Saucer Full of Secrets. We played some songs from that album last week. And since I made sure that I got all the Syd stuff covered then, so now we're going to hear sort of what the problem is, to be honest, by portraying what was coming from some of the other band members and how different it was. First thing I want to play is a song that was written by Rick Wright, who was the band's keyboard player. This is a song that he wrote around the time of the band's first album, called Piper at the Gates of Dawn. And not too convincingly, but on at least by topic, the song is very closely related to the type of stuff that Syd would write, because it's a song about childhood. Or in this case, maybe the problems of growing up from being a child, from adolescence to becoming an adult. The song is called Remember a Day, and it's one of the first songs that the Floyd recorded for their second album, Saucer Full of Secrets. There's various sources quote an interview that from 1968 where Rick Wright was saying, "I was self-taught and my only group was Pink Floyd. I wasn't featured on everything, but I did. Oh, well, this actually, this was Syd Barrett saying this because I did play on a track that was written by Richard Wright. So Syd is on this track, although there's not yet, there's, you know, it's, he's not on the album very much. If you listen, though, it is Syd Barrett who plays almost all of the guitar parts on this song. That's him playing acoustic rhythm guitar, and he also, you'll hear his reverb on of the fact that he actually plays a solo, which you might almost think it's David Gilmour, because he really did do a great job playing his playing guitar on this song. It's called Remember a Day.
Remember a day before
not a bad attempt at sort of mimicking what Sid was trying to do there with that one written by Rick Wright for the second album. But it wasn't representing the direction that the band was thinking about going in per se. I think the next song does that quite well. It's interesting to note that in the lyrics of the song we just heard, Remember a Day, Rick Wright sings, "Why can't we reach the sun?" And this next song answers that question. It was one of the first songs, his first compositions written by Roger Waters. And it's really one of the first songs that he wrote that this could actually stand up with what Sid had been doing. So it's like seeming that maybe the band is going to stand a chance of surviving because of Rick Wright's ability to write, and most importantly, Roger Waters developing an ability to write as he changed the direction of the band to head in a totally different way. Because he answers that question about why can't we reach the sun with a song that's called Set the Controls for the Heart of the Sun, which is essentially, it's a song about somebody who is flying some sort of an interstellar spacecraft, that sort of thing, and ends up becoming incredibly depressed in space and has the suicidal tendency of wanting to fly directly into the sun. And that's more or less the meaning of the song, of what Roger's going for. The book Pink Floyd, All the Songs, states, "Set the Controls for the Heart of the Sun is perhaps the most interesting song in relation to what we were doing at the time, according to Nick Mason, the band's drummer, since it had been constructed to make the most of what we had learned." So, here is Set the Controls for the Heart of the Sun.
The light of the sun, the light of the sun, the light of the sun.
With that, I am going to move on from their second album, although I could be playing the album's title track, Saucer Full of Secrets. And, of course, I normally would. The thing is, the song itself is 12 minutes long, and that's not the reason I'm not going to play it. The reason I don't want to play this version, the studio version, is because there are two other versions that are, I'd say, vastly superior. And one of them is the live version on Omagumma or the live version at Pompeii. So I'm going to choose one of those two, and we'll eventually get to that relatively soon. But that ends up eating a tremendous amount of what real musical, you know, relevance there is on the second album. And it also kind of points out how the album was nowhere near as interesting as the debut album, Piper at the Gates of Dawn, which had about seven absolutely masterful songs written by Syd Barrett. So this brings us to the real problem at the heart of the matter. In April 13th, 1968, Pink Floyd decided to release another single. Up to this point, all of their singles were Syd's. Syd was the hit writer. So in this instance, they bring Richard Wright, the keyboard player, to see if he could come up with something. Now, as we had heard on Remember a Day, we could see that he did a pretty good job of more or less sticking to the same sort of topicality or subject matter that Syd would have used, which is to say, you know, childhood and growing up. And in this song, he kind of is trying to do it again. I think that what I hear, like this Richard Wright, trying to be a more cohesive version of Syd, which is a sad thing because the most beautiful thing about Syd is that he wasn't cohesive. It's what made the song so interesting. But he wrote this song. It's called It Would Be So Nice, and it sounds like it's just a song about a British, you know, a day in the life of a normal British person, except for the fact that as the song goes on, he eventually talks about a dream that sends them reeling to a distant place, which is him again, maybe trying to just touch base with Syd. A person who is a critic of Pink Floyd wrote books on him. His name is John Harris. This is what he states about the song. The first recorded work that they released in the wake of Syd Barrett's exit was Richard Wright's almost unbearably whimsical It Would Be So Nice, a single whose lightweight strain of pop psychedelia rendered it a non-event that failed to trouble the British charts. Here's It Would Be So Nice.
It would be so your I would just like to say,
such a strange song as a Pink Floyd thing, because it is neither one nor the other. It's not a Syd Barrett type song really at all, and it's definitely not going in the direction where Roger was trying to go, taking it away from psychedelic and toward progressive. So it ended up kind of going nowhere. Now, the B-side of the single, a very short song that is written by Rogers, by Roger Waters. And it's interesting because it happened to be the very first song that the band recorded without Syd Barrett after he had left. Although he was still officially a member, he was actually not showing up in the studio at this point, and he was gone. And the thing most convincing about that aspect of it is that it's the first song with David Gilmour singing the lead vocal. Even though it's written by Roger, David sings it. And it's the second song written by Roger Waters as a solo songwriter. So here's that B-side. It's called Julia Dream.
Sunlight bright upon my pillow, lighter than an eiderdown. Will she let the his branches round? Julia Dream, dream that queen, queen of all my dreams. Every night I turn the light out, waiting for the velvet blind. Will the scaly armadillo find me? Break me, will the key unlock my mind? Will the following footsteps catch me? Am I really dying?
That's quite a dream.
Psychedelic, right? Let me remind you that you're listening to American at Radio, the How Music Changed series on Fridays on 90.3 WHPC, WHPC HD. We are in the midst of part four in our coverage of the history of Pink Floyd, moving our way for the, right now we're at the point in time between albums number two A Saucer Full of Secrets, and number three, which we will get to soon, after we play one more song, which was another single that followed It Would Be So Nice and Julia Dream. Perhaps one that is a little bit more in the style of what you'd expect from Pink Floyd. It's written as a pairing together, Roger Waters and David Gilmour. I believe it's the very first time that they had written a song together, that they had co-composed it. It's called Point Me at the Sky. And they wrote it because EMI was begging them for a single, since the last one didn't do anything. And they still really believed that singles were the most important way for the band to promote themselves. So although Syd Barrett was obviously no longer a part of the band at all when this was recorded, you can tell that Roger Waters is still very much aware of what Syd brought to the table, with him singing a song which basically contains nursery rhymes. And in this instance, it's about a man named Henry McLean who builds a cosmic glider and asks his friend Eugene to fly with him into the sky. It doesn't work out well, though, for Eugene and Henry. As you'll hear in the lyrics, here is Point Me at the Sky.
Hey, Eugene, this is Henry McLean, and I've finished my beautiful flying machine, and I'm ringing to say that I'm leaving, and maybe you'd like to fly with me and hide with me, baby. Isn't it strange how little we change? Isn't it sad we're insane? Playing the games that we know end in tears, the games we've been playing for thousands and thousands and thousands.
Crash, crash, goodbye. Point me at the sky. The B-side of that single, by the way, was a six-minute version of Careful With That Axe, Eugene. a rather remarkable title for a song. But like Saucer Full of Secrets, I'm going to save it for a later, better version than the one that was, although this is a rare version, as it's just the single version, I'd rather move on to play one of the better versions that appear on later albums. Which brings us to the third album, an album that is entitled More, which was the name of the movie that the songs were written for. Now, More was not the first time that Pink Floyd had collaborated with motion pictures. If you go all the way back to part one, we were talking about how they were getting involved with films, because they already, you know, did music for a few documentaries, including Peter Whitehead's Jeanetta Cochran and Tonight, Let's All Make Love in London, which I was where I took the background songs for when we played part one in this series. But More was the first time that they had written music specifically for a movie. As Rick Wright commented, films seem to be the answer for us at the moment. It would be nice to do a science fiction movie. Our music seems to be that way oriented, which is all well and true, but you can tell that they are realizing that they're not having hits. Their singles failed, and the albums are not selling fabulously, although the first one did well, and Sid's singles did well. So they're thinking that this might be what they have to resort to for a career. The thing is, like, they want to do a science fiction movie, but this movie, More, is the furthest thing from a science fiction movie that you could possibly imagine. It's basically about a very a drug-induced love story and self-destruction that comes about, you know, during the relationship. It's a pretty dark movie. The director basically approached the band with the film, and it was already complete and even edited. So, Nick Mason said, despite these constraints and a fairly desperate deadline, the director was an easy man to work with. We were paid £600 each, which was a substantial amount in 1968 for 8 days' work. And there was little pressure to provide Oscar-winning songs or any Hollywood-style soundtrack. In fact, complementing the various mood sequences, Roger came up with a number of songs for the film that would later become part of the band's live shows for some time. So let's play two of the songs that served as backing music for the film More. The first one we'll hear is written by Roger Waters. It's called Cirrus Minor. And we'll follow that with another Roger Waters song entitled The Nile Song.
In a churchyard by a river, blazing in the haze of midday, laughing in the grasses and the graves. Yellow bird, you are not long in singing and in flying on, in laughing and in leaving. Willow weeping in the water. waving to the river daughters, swaying in the ripples and the reefs. On a trip to Cirrus Minor, saw a crater in the sun, a thousand miles of moonlight later. Thank you.
Yeah, and now for something completely different, right? I mean, up until this point, what did the Pink Floyd have to do with hard rock? They had not even remotely did anything close to hard rock. And all of a sudden, here's the Nile song, which is definitely them sounding more like Black Sabbath than Pink Floyd, right? It's just, it's almost weird. And that's David Gilmour who was singing it. Now, David Gilmour, up until this point, just sang with the most incredible, gentle, quiet voice. And there he's like basically yelling and screaming, and it's just really intense. It's just really odd. But again, it's for a movie soundtrack, so you get that sort of diversity on an album like that. Both of those songs were written by Roger Waters, and as is this next song that I want to play from it. It's called The Crying Song, and I like the notes here from Pink Floyd, all the songs, and it says that it's worth drawing attention here to the extraordinary progress made by Roger Waters in the art of songwriting at this point. It says, interesting though they are, his songs like Careful With That Axe, Eugene, Let There Be More Light, Set the Controls for the Hearts of the Sun, had given little hint to any sense of like a melody or emotion in his songwriting. So his bandmates, they're saying they must have felt relieved that now Roger is actually writing something that sounds like it could maybe start taking the place of what Sid had done, because this, it's completely different from what Sid did, but it sounds like Roger is at least writing songs that could maybe begin to imply a new direction. This is called The Crying Song.
Help me roll away the
All right, we've got time for one. That was called The Crying Song. And I guess you could hear a bit of an inkling of the direction of Pink Floyd developing there with that track. Now, we've got time for one more. Heidi, I got to give you a heads up because I'm going to play the song Cymbeline to close out. It's another Roger Waters song. And we'll be back next week with part five, playing another track or two from the soundtrack more. And then we get deeper into the band's following album, Amagama. So we'll see you then. Take care, folks.
The path you tread is narrow, and the drop is sheer and very high. The ravens all are watching. Vantage point nearby, apprehension creeping like a tube train up your spine. Will the tightrope reach the end? Will a final couplet rhyme? And it's high time, Cymbeline. It's high time, Cymbeline. Butterfly with broken wings is falling by your side. The ravens all are closing in, there's nowhere you can hide. Your manager and agent are both busy on the phone, selling colored photographs to magazines back home. Stand. They must have moved the picture plane. The leaves are heavy around your feet. You hear the thunder of the train. Suddenly it strikes you that they're moving into range. And Doctor Strange is always changing sides.